Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Denny Rancourt. Denny has been on a good number of times before. We want to talk more about the terrible injustice that's been inflicted against him. It's been ongoing for many, many months. We've discussed it on the program on and off. And it seems to go from one chapter to another chapter. And when I get connected with Denny, I'll let him get on and explain the latest things that are going on. It's really hard to believe that a man of his distinction would be put to the travails that he's endured for so many months by the University of Ottawa that should have honored him, and the entire Canadian judicial system, which is no better than the American judicial system, just as unjust, and it shows in the way it operates. Before I get going with Denny, let me mention one thing. There was one big piece of news this morning. It was not unexpected. It was the death of Ariel Sharon. It was coming. He's been in a stroke-induced coma for the past 8 years. There was really speculation of whether he really had died, and Israel simply didn't want to say anything about it because he was so reviled throughout the Middle East, the Arab street, for good reason, so reviled for obvious reasons for people who know his record. A mass murderer writ large. Well, I wrote an article several days ago. I held it back, waiting for what happened today. I'll get it out tomorrow. And I titled my article, Ariel Sharon's Criminal Legacy. That says it about as well as anything I could think of, and indeed so. It began a long time ago. He died at age 85. He was around before Israel became Israel. He was around with what was called the Haganah before, in 1948, it became the IDF. He was involved in some of the most brutal Israeli brigades, and one of them was called Unit 101. It committed abominable crimes of war and against humanity. And Sharon believed in this. He believed in this. When he was a boy, his father gave him a dagger to protect himself against so-called enemies. I can't imagine who they were. Certainly he hadn't. Well, I don't. Unless it was a vendetta out against his family, that I know nothing about. There certainly was nothing to protect himself against. I don't have any daggers in my household. I don't have any guns. I don't have any weapons of any sort. I want nothing to do with those things. Well, Sharon, as a young boy, never forgot that. It was a symbol for him. It was a symbol to be harsh against people he claimed were enemies, ones he created out of whole cloth. He hated Arabs. And in my article, I added a comment. I'm certain he believed this, that the only good Arabs were dead Arabs. And his policy certainly proved that. Again, going back to pre-1948, absolutely astonishing. But he did it. He fought in Israel's so-called War of Independence. He fought in its subsequent wars. He had a long military career. His most despicable act was in 1982. He was defense minister at the time. Israel invaded Lebanon. Pure aggression. What Nuremberg tribunal judges called the supreme crime against peace. The absolute greatest of all crimes. And that's what Israel committed. But of course it committed it many times. 1982 was one of the worst. About 20,000 Palestinians were murdered. I guess Lebanese as well, with mostly Palestinians. Murdered in cold blood. And the most infamous parts were the Sabra and Shatila refugee camp massacres, where Sharon held back Israeli forces. He allied with the so-called phalangists in Lebanon, fascists. He let them do his killing for them. And killing they did over a couple of days. I don't know how you could kill so many people in a couple of days, as many as 17 or 18,000 people. I don't know how many of the phalangists there were. But they literally murdered people in their homes, men, women, children, infants, didn't matter, slaughtered them all in cold blood, shot them, slit their throats, beheaded them, whatever they did. Sharon bore direct responsibility for it. None of it would have happened if it wasn't for Sharon. He basically ordered this to be done, but instead of having Israeli soldiers did it, he let these fascist killers do it for him. He never was fully chastised for what happened. A mildly critical report came out afterwards, the so-called Kahan Commission. It was nothing but a slap on the wrist. He fell out of favor with Israel's military because he was very independent, arrogant, and did whatever he damn pleased, no matter what his superiors wanted. So he never made it all the way up the ranks to head the IDF. He decided he no longer wanted to be in the military, and he left. Then he got called back for the 1973 so-called Yom Kippur War. Afterwards, he came out, and he chose politics instead of the military as his future career. And he worked his way up that way, and finally he became prime minister. He certainly was one of the worst, if not the worst. I like to write, and I've said it many times, I think, and I really do believe, that the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, exceeds the worst of Ariel Sharon. Netanyahu was his finance minister at one time, and he didn't like Sharon, and I quoted what he said in my article. I would imagine maybe the feelings were mutual. If you dislike the guy you're working for, it's pretty hard not to show it. So probably Sharon picked up the vibes anyway. This is the way Israel works. The politicians circulate throughout others' governments. So you can be a prime minister, then you can be a defense minister, then you can be a finance minister, then you can be a prime minister again. That's the way it works in Israel. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong is the criminal government that Israel runs, not just your own. You could go back to the days of David Ben-Gurion, the very beginning. He planned the mass slaughter, ethnic cleansing of Palestinians on the order of 800,000 of them, beginning around December 1947, continuing through May 1948, Israel's so-called independence war. Well, independence at the expense of stealing another country's land. And that's exactly what happened. Slaughtering men, women, and children. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's George Washington. Well, it continued long after he was gone. This is the legacy of Israel. This is the legacy of all of its leaders. Some were worse than others. None of them were Democrats. Israel is no democracy. It never was. And for sure it isn't now. It's a deplorable police state. It practices the same neoliberal harshness that goes on in America and across Europe and Canada. Ordinary Israelis suffer. Poverty in Israel is extremely high. Most people don't know that. All kinds of injustices occur in Israel. Sharon played his part. Then, are we connected? Not yet. I have a very detailed article about him coming tomorrow. I think it exceeds 2,000 words. It really covers his whole career. And I welcome listeners to find it on my blog site. I'll top feature it on my blog site tomorrow morning. Again, it's called Ariel Sharon's Criminal Legacy. And indeed it is. It's all there from the public record. You can't hide the truth. And it'll be there. I added a section at the end this morning after his death was announced. I wanted to mention what world leaders said about him. So I quoted three. Obviously, I started out with Obama. I included Britain's David Cameron, France's François Hollande, and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. You can pretty much imagine what those people had to say. Certainly wasn't what I had to say. They disgraced themselves with their comments, but it was expected. I also quoted a Fatah official and a Hamas official, and they said briefly what needs to be said. I hope I did in much greater detail. Press TV had me on this morning. I was very delighted they called. I was on for about 30 minutes, very long to have an interview that long on Press TV. I was on with three of its correspondents, one in Beirut, one in Gaza, and one in the West Bank. And I was delighted to be asked to come on with them, so we shared the half hour with comments. They included their own thoughts, and they included thoughts on people's reaction on the ground, which is very important. Palestinians' reaction, Lebanon across border. Lebanon very important because of the horrors that Israel committed against Lebanon, not just Ariel Sharon, but of course he committed the worst horror in 1982. And I would add that Lebanon remained occupied from 1982 to around May 2000, using Lebanese fighters, again, against their own people. So the horrors that continued against the Lebanese people. And then in 2006, I think it was before Sharon's stroke. He was prime minister at the time. I'll have to go back and check that. Around mid-year, around June 2006, Israel bombed Lebanon for a good number of days, and I wrote about it. It was one of my early articles. I wrote at least a couple of articles. Displaced something like a third of the population. Lebanon's a small country. Can you imagine displacing a third or so of a country's population? I have to go back and check these numbers. It's been so long, 2006. I know it was well over a million people. It might have been a couple of million. There were many killed. I think it was over 100,000 killed, many displaced, immense destruction, gratuitous destruction. And there was a word that became symbolic that came out of that war, and the word was Dahiya, a Lebanese town. Israel targeted it, targeted civilians, and generals in the Israeli army said afterwards, well, I would say first off, the so-called Dahiya became an Israeli Dahiya doctrine. And the doctrine was this, as stated by Israeli generals, that civilians are legitimate targets when Israel goes to war. They consider them as much combatants as real combatants. They consider their infrastructure that way, their homes, their schools, their mosques, their other property. International law has an entirely different opinion on this. Israel, international law calls it war crimes, to put it very simply. Danny, are we connected?
Yes, we are.
Oh, I'm delighted we finally got connected. I wanted to take a few moments, which I did, and I'll let you jump in. I don't know how much of what I said you heard, but...
Just the last few minutes.
Just the last few minutes. I commented on Ariel Sharon's death and the article that I will put out tomorrow that I call Ariel Sharon's Criminal Legacy. And I wanted I could spend the whole hour talking about it because there's so much. I mean, you go back to a guy who began his criminality pre-1948. There's an awful lot to talk about, Danny.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I don't know where you want to go with that.
Well, if you have any thoughts on Sharon, I'd love to hear it, or an occupied Palestine, and we can jump into your personal situation, which I do want to get into.
Well, I'm just generally very disturbed by the influence that Israel has in Canada, the United States, and countries like France and the UK. I'm just very disturbed by that. I don't think that an outside country like Israel should have that kind of influence. And I don't think it's legitimate that it has that kind of influence and that that the Israel lobby can determine what can and cannot be said in the media, for example. There's a really large, high-profile case of that in France at the moment. I don't know if your listeners have heard of that. Because it's happening in France, we don't generally talk about it in the English media. But there is a French, very high-profile French comedian by the name of Dieudonné, who, is critical of Israel. And he's being treated like he is, performing hate crimes every time he opens his mouth, which is completely ridiculous. He's saying his performances are making statements and criticisms that need to be made. And he went from being a national star on national TV to being excluded from all media that the state controls, and to having the president of the country saying to city mayors to not allow him to perform in their cities. I mean, it's just outrageous what's happening with this fellow, who is, a brave critical thinker, who is saying precisely what needs to be said regarding Israel's behavior in the world. And he got into this battle because he started saying that, there wasn't only the Nazi Holocaust, but there have been other genocidal Holocausts that are as large or larger in recent history. For example, the black slave trade from Africa. And he wanted to talk about that. He wanted to talk about France's role in that and so on. And it was like he was daring to suggest that the Nazi Holocaust wasn't the all-important thing that justifies all of Israel's crimes. So there's have you heard of that case?
Yes, I have, Daddy. It really is absolutely outrageous. And as far as World War II goes and Nazi Holocaust, the Nazis committed a number of Holocausts, and a much greater one was against the Slavic people. It was on the order of maybe three times the Jewish Holocaust. I mean, the Nazis discriminated. The Nazis went after all non-Aryans. They just had some they hated more than others, but they sure hated a lot of people.
Yes, and went after the gypsies in a big way as well.
Yes.
And anyone who was homosexual or gay or whatever, they rounded them up and put them into the same concentration camps. I mean, a large, large fraction of their destruction and imprisonments and murders were people other than Jewish people. But we never hear about that. It's always minimized.
Oh, absolutely. Anybody the Nazis called a communist or a trade unionist, I mean, these people were targeted for elimination.
Yes, yes. So, but I think Professor Finkelstein explained this phenomenon quite well as it pertains to the U.S. and Canada in his book called The Holocaust Industry.
Yes, I read it.
Yeah, that's a magnificent piece of scholarship, which is so well researched, which explains in detail how you can use the popular reaction to a genocide in order to reinforce your political aims, and how you can bring that into the mass consciousness in that way and manipulate it. And so his book is absolutely brilliant in that regard. And you can see it playing out precisely in France at the moment. It's really disturbing. So, I don't know how we got onto that topic, but they're all related. All of this insanity is related, isn't it?
Danny, it's very much related, and I would add there have been a few instances over the years when U.S. On-air people, either program hosts or maybe a guest, but usually it would be somebody affiliated with the networks like CNN or Fox or one of those, and there have been instances where one of these people made almost an inadvertent comment that was even mildly critical of Israel. They were summarily, if they were a part of the staff of CNN or one of the other broadcasters or cable companies, they were fired on the spot.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the machine is powerful and vicious. I mean, look at what's happening to the American Studies Association right now.
Yes.
Have you written about that?
I wrote three times about it.
Yeah. It's really, really disturbing there as well. I mean, they're going after them legally. There's lawsuits. They're passing bills to exclude their funding. They're questioning their tax-free status as a nonprofit organization. I mean, they're just going after this association without pity, just ferociously. Why? Why? Because they dare to take a public principled stand on the Israeli state's behavior.
Oh, indeed, actually, what they did, Denny, was they targeted Israel's academia. Basically, it's universities, and I wrote in both of my articles, one in great detail, that academia, if I could put it that way, from kindergarten to the highest levels, Israeli children are taught from when they're in short pants throughout the highest form of higher education, militarism, belligerence, hating Arabs, the whole works. This is the entire indoctrination, brainwashing of Israel's academic system, and it's all there in black and white. And I wrote about it. There've been reports on it. There've been studies done on it. It's all there for anybody to see. So to take on the Israel's educational system—that's probably a better way of putting it. It absolutely is essential to do, and that's what the ASA did.
Right. But I have, you know, I have to say, I'm going to be a bit of a counterweight here. I have to say I have more respect for Israel's education system, which outright is racist and encourages racism, than the Canadian education system, which says it's anti-racist but that it's okay to invade countries like Syria and so on because you're bringing them democracy. And that's not racist, you see. I have more respect for a system, no matter how brutal, that's at least honest, versus a brutal system that is devious and playing with our minds in this way. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. And the expression that I like to use often, Denny, is to refer to the big lie or the big lies. And the idea that Washington or Canada or European countries invade Middle East countries or any others, any place else, to bring democracy. I wonder how many people buy that nonsense now. I mean, at one time it was a big selling point, but after repeatedly it's proved to be a big lie. I wonder how many people really believe it now.
Well, I think a lot of people believe it and buy it in the general sense. I mean, they realize it's not about bringing democracy in the literal sense, but they accept it in terms of, you know, these countries are misbehaving, they're a danger to the global community, and therefore it's better to take out these people. You know, I think they accept it in that kind of a way, which is really frightening that a lot of people would accept that the U.S. can be trusted to be the global police and come in and destroy entire nations in order to have some political influence and to stop independence of a nation, independent action, independent self-determination, and so on. The rule is, if anyone indicates that they want that kind of independence, then they're an enemy. They're on the list of enemies, absolute enemies. So that would, of course, include Russia and China, which can't be easily invaded, but it includes any other country as well. If you're not obeying and being part of the financially exploited and controlled nations on the planet, or part of the select club that does the exploiting, and that would be the U.S., Canada, the U.K., France, you know, the main players that play this role, that participate in doing this, then you're an enemy. It's black and white like that for these political designers.
Denny, that's absolutely right. Any nation that is independent, that isn't pro-Western, that isn't pro-Israel, is vulnerable for regime change. These are the ones that are targeted. It doesn't matter whether they're democracies or run by despots or anything in between. I mean, America and Israel are closely allied with some of the worst despots on earth. But, you know, they're buddy-buddy with each other. They support each other's agenda, so they get along fine. But when you get a sovereign, independent country like Afghanistan or Libya or Iraq or Syria, these are the ones that get targeted. And then, of course, all the big lies proliferate a lot of nonsense about why this is being done. You know, they're harming their people, they're doing this, they're doing that. I mean, just outrageous lies that are told about the governments that run these countries and the leaders of these countries. And it's interesting to me, Denny, and I hope it's a hopeful sign. I'll have to. It's not hopeful enough because I don't see people in the streets demanding what they say their opinions are. But I remember back at the height of the anti-Vietnam protests, the anti-Afghanistan sentiment, based on recent polls as late as December last month, show that over 80% of the U.S. public are against the Afghanistan war. And the intense anti-Vietnam War sentiment never came close to those kinds of numbers. But the difference is that people put their bodies where their sentiment was. They came out in the street en masse. It was on college campuses. It was very, very in the face of government leaders and the military. And today, it's completely absent, and that's the big difference.
Yes, but also there was a conscription.
You
were necessarily part of it. You were in harm's way, personally, and your friends were, your family was, in a very real way, and they couldn't hide it through these economic tricks and deception, you know, that they're hiring you into a job and that you're signing a contract, and therefore you're bound by that, you know, create economic hardship and then give everybody a military job. They hadn't developed those methods yet. So, that's a big part of why the resistance was more direct and more personalized in Vietnam days, right? I think.
Oh yeah, I think that was a very big part of it. And it was so often, Denny, that, as I like to put it, society's least advantaged were the ones that were mostly on the firing lines. I mean, ordinary people, poor people, people of color, you didn't see the sons and daughters of America's elite putting their bodies on the line. I mean, there were some, and they were the exceptions more than the rule. I mean, you had John McCain, who was a Navy pilot, and he got shot down. He was a Navy pilot. I guess he flew off an aircraft carrier. I imagine that if he was a Navy pilot. You had John McCain, John Kerry, who was a Vietnam veteran, and back then he testified before Congress, absolutely appalled at the atrocities that America was responsible for. At one point, he won medals. At one point, he was so upset, he threw his medals back, and there was a point back in the 1970s, he literally threw his medals back. He gave them back. He was so upset. And now he's a real war hawk. He supports all America's wars. Once he got into Congress, into the Senate, he absolutely became a war hawk. He just turned around, became polar opposite of his former self. But again, he was a guy who was in the war, but so many of them, a senior Bush was in World War II. Junior Bush, he was in the International Guard. And, I think the only combat I think he saw was whether he had a scrap with somebody on one of the bases. He certainly didn't go and see combat during the Vietnam War. His daddy kept him out of it.
What about this young soldier from those days, Hugh Thompson Jr.? Do you know about him?
No, I don't.
Okay, he was one of the people that fought against his other U.S. soldiers during the My Lai massacre.
Mm.
And actually saved people who were being massacred, and actually used his gunship to threaten away the other U.S. Military that were participating in this massacre that was being overseen from the air by the high commanders, you know?
Eddie, I know exactly who you mean because I remember there was a U.S., I guess, helicopter pilot who witnessed what was going on and was appalled by it, but I didn't know his name.
Yes, Hugh Thompson Jr. There were these brave heroes that, I mean, for someone to be able to oppose the hierarchical structure directly in that way is remarkable. It's remarkable. It reminds me of our current day heroes regarding whistleblowing, regarding government crimes and so on.
Absolutely. Bradley Manning certainly comes to mind.
Yeah.
Denny, let's take a break and we'll come right back.
Sure.
Welcome back. Talking with Denny Rancourt. Denny, let's get on to your situation, and I think this is very important. You sent me some information. It is really shocking what you tell me because it's such a blatant injustice. I think this goes on all too often in one form or another, what's happening in your personal situation. But your case, it's so blatant that it calls for something entirely different from what's happening. But you put it this way. You're filing application with the Supreme Court of Canada for your legitimate right to be involved in your case in an impartial court, and the Ontario Superior Court judge involved in your case, as you put it, has strong personal, family, emotional, and contractual financial ties to a party intervening for the plaintiff in your case, and also the law firm representing this party, and the judge won't recuse himself. That really goes beyond the pale, Denny.
Yes. Well, just to clarify just a little bit, he refuses to rule, he has an obligation to rule on whether or not there's at least an appearance of bias on his part, given those factual circumstances. He refuses to do that, which puts me in a difficult position, but at the same time, he did recuse himself, but he recused himself for other reasons moving forward. In other words, what he said was, I'm so upset by how you brought this complaint of bias forward. I'm so upset that you would dare to mention these things. I'm paraphrasing into my own words, that, you know, you're the most despicable person I've ever seen in my entire career. Remember, this is a judge who's had to deal with murderers and criminals and so on. I'm so that was so despicable that I cannot be impartial moving forward. So I'm going to recuse myself, but at the same time, refuse to make the required ruling on whether or not these other factual circumstances are cause for an appearance of bias, which would then have removed all of his past rulings, you see. So it leaves his rulings intact. And then he also continued to release decisions after he had recused himself. And all of those decisions continue to stand. So that's the kind of situation I find myself in.
It's pretty despicable. It's hard to find the right words, Denny, to explain just how unjust this entire thing is. But it literally, the entire system is rigged against you. What do you think the Supreme Court will have to say on this?
Well, unfortunately, they don't have to intervene. They don't have to grant me my leave to appeal. I'm asking for leave so that they will look at this and correct all of the errors of the courts below. I mean, seven judges have looked at this and have all found a way to, circumvent my right to an impartial judge and my right to have a judicial ruling on whether or not there was an appearance of bias. Because under the law, an appearance of bias is as serious as actual bias. And the reason for that is it's sometimes very difficult to prove actual bias because you have to look into the judge's mind, but an appearance of bias one can demonstrate because you simply look at the facts. You know, is there a contractual financial tie or not? You know, if there's a contract there, and I obtained a copy of the contract and I showed it there, and all of these things. And you know, the judge was even interviewed in the media. And he said, it was reported in the article, quoting him, saying how important this financial contract that created a scholarship at the university that was in the case, how important that was emotionally to him, how it was part of him preserving the memory of his son and this kind of thing. So he himself has given testimony in the media of how important these things are to him, yet he didn't disclose them to the parties in the case. He never disclosed them until I discovered them and brought it to court and said, look, I'd like to have a ruling on whether or not this is an appearance of bias. And then he lost decorum in the courtroom, threatened me with contempt of court, and recused himself because of, according to him, the manner in which I had brought this forward. And so it's very disturbing that a judge could get out of his obligation to rule on his own bias or appearance of bias by accusing the person that's bringing the complaint of being so inappropriate in bringing the complaint that this now makes him biased, so he's going to recuse himself, but without making the required legal decision that would have corrected all of his past rulings. You see that problem? It's a very big problem. And then I brought this to six other judges, and they all refused to look at it in one way or another, like it should have been looked at. So I've been doing this for a couple of years now, and I'm now at the Supreme Court, and I'm saying, look, you must address this. You must look at it. And it turns out that the executive director of the Ontario Civil Liberties Association was in the courtroom when the judge in question lost decorum. So he's a witness to this. and he provided an affidavit as part of my supporting material for the Supreme Court of Canada. So I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do, but unfortunately, it can do what it often does, which is to deny leave without giving any reason or explanation as to why it has done that. But if the Supreme Court does deny leave, then I think that they will be reneging on that highest court's own obligations, because there is a Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada, and that charter says that if one of my rights is being curtailed, then there's an obligation for a court in Canada, a competent court in Canada, to look at that. And no court has agreed to look at it so far. And therefore, I think that if you accept that element of the charter, the Supreme Court has to say, well, one of the courts below has to look at this, or will look at it, but they have to intervene if they're going to follow the charter themselves. You see?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't pay any attention to the U.S. Constitution, did they?
Yeah. I know. I'm only saying, in an ideal world, if the courts themselves followed their own rules, how it would go. But I realize that in reality, the court has the power, to simply not explain why it's refusing, an application like this. So, we'll see what the court decides to do. But I am completely outraged that this could happen. I'm in the middle of it. I can see it in detail. I've seen every step of it. I've seen every mechanism that was used to not properly address my complaint on its merits and properly look at the facts and properly explain how it is that, given these facts, this is not even an appearance of bias. So because I'm so in the thick of it, and because I know the evidence so well, I feel that it's my responsibility to talk about this and to make it as public as possible and to get it out there to people that, you know, the courts in general in Ontario, and hopefully it won't be the Supreme Court as well that will contribute to this, but the courts are misbehaving. And this is an egregious example of something that never should have happened and that should have been stopped immediately. I mean, the judge, when I brought it to the judge, he should have, in his wisdom, said, I understand you're making this complaint of apparent bias. I will put aside a time where I will hear a motion on this. You will present the evidence fully, and it will be considered, and the opposing parties, if they don't agree, they will present their argument, and then I will make a decision about my own appearance of bias, whether or not I feel there is one, and then you'll have a right to appeal that decision, and or to ask for leave to appeal that decision. And so if you feel that I've made the wrong decision, there's a next step as well. But the way that it was done, I was deprived of all of that. So this would mean that a judge in Canada, any time that a judge in Canada is accused, or is, if you bring a complaint to a judge in Canada about appearance of bias, they'll be able to say, how dare you? Well, now that you've done that, I can't be impartial with regards to you moving forward, so I'm going to recuse myself without making the judicial determination of whether or not there was an appearance of bias, and therefore you won't be allowed any further recourse, and all my decisions up to now will stand. That any judge could do that. If they get away with it this time, that means they can always do this, which is a pretty, I think, unacceptable procedure.
Oh, Danny, it's a very unacceptable procedure. And again, the same kinds of things, you know, to a greater or lesser extent happen in the U.S. courts, mostly the federal courts, but it can happen at the state and local level as well, but it's mostly the federal courts. And I know in America, because I've written about so many cases, the federal courts are stacked with right-wing extremists, and the Supreme Court is as well, where most of the judges come from the so-called Federalist Society. It's an extreme right-wing organization. I mean, they're anti-everything that you and I believe in, and it shows in most of their decisions. It really is terrible. And even the so-called less hardline judges, they can be pretty hardline based on some of the decisions they make. And it shows from the individuals who I've written about who've had such great injustices committed against them, that the only way for possible recourse is individuals on their own taking their case to the public and doing it over and over again. But it's so hard for ordinary people to attract a big enough following. Just a handful of people can do it. And even then, really, does anything ever get done judicially in their favor, like Leonard Poitier in America, like Mumia Abu-Jamal, the case of Lynn Stewart dragged on for 4 years. She was very lucky. She finally was released on New Year's Day. But it took a horrendous battle, a battle of public opinion, to get her released. But there are so many others that have been unjustly treated. Another major one for me is a Pakistani national who lived and went to school through the PhD level in America, a woman by the name of Afia Siddiqui. And she was wrongfully charged for things she never did. And she ended up being tortured for years, given a prison sentence of 86 years, which she's serving now. And it's one of the grossest injustices I ever heard of. And this woman, no matter what happens to her, from this day going forward, her life has been destroyed. That's how bad it is. The toll, the emotional, the physical toll that America did to her for a number of years, including the torture and everything else, she would never be the same person again. And this is the way America runs its system. And very sadly, I guess Canada does a lot of the same things.
Well, what I've come to understand about the courts, and it must be the same in the States, I think it must be the same in most countries, I've been reading a lot of case law, a lot of decisions. I'm aware of a lot of cases, and my own, of course, in detail. But what I've come to understand is that, you know, people will often say something that's not true about the courts. They'll say, well, as you go to higher and higher courts, as you appeal to higher levels, it gets more and more just. You know, the higher courts have more wisdom, they have a greater knowledge of the law, they have more distance from it, so they can see more clearly what's going on. And, you know, you hear this a lot. It's completely untrue. Let me explain. It's true that the higher courts can correct errors, technical legal errors. It's true that they're less emotional, and so that they can correct emotional decisions or decisions that were sometimes just in the local circumstances, racist or otherwise. So they can do that, and they do correct those little flaws. But on the whole, as you go higher and higher, the court is more and more political. It will make political decisions. The bigger the case in terms of its political repercussions, the more politicized the decision will be as you go to higher and higher appeals. It seems obvious to me when I look at the cases that I've studied. So, now, of course, the lower courts can be political as well, but they do it by gut, whereas the higher courts, it's by design. You know, they'll exclude cases that they feel that there should not be a challenge to the establishment through this case. And it'll be a political exclusion. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't think they necessarily put it in that language. They don't. They don't maybe even admit it to themselves, but if you look at what's actually done, if you do an institutional analysis of how they're actually running and the kinds of decisions they make, the higher you go, the more political it is, the more airtight political it is. Have you observed that kind of thing?
I think so. I really think so. There are occasional lower court justices that are a little bit more, on the right side of doing the right thing than some other justices. But at the same time, they seem to be the exceptions, not the rule. But it really is disgraceful. We're the highest court in the land. They really, really, really should be the final wear of real justice for people. It can be so hard line doing the wrong thing. And that's exactly the way it's been in America for so many years, where usually, as you say, Denny, they can just dismiss you out of hand. They don't need to give you the time of day. And that's what the U.S. Supreme Court does most of the time. And there's a statement, I've quoted it in some articles that I've written. I don't have it in front of me, but it's basically a one-liner or so kiss off. Just basically telling people we don't give a damn about you in I guess legalese language, or the language of the court. Let me put it that way. It's in plain English, but in the language of the court. But it's a kiss off, saying they simply don't care enough about you to give you the time of day.
Yeah. The pretext they use is that they don't have the resources to look at every single appeal, and therefore they make a very judicious selection. And the way they rationalize it is to say that they only pick the cases that are important to society in terms of improving the law or improving the jurisprudence and so on. And so that's their rationalization. That's at least the pretext that they present. But when you look at the cases they do select in Canada, they're ridiculous cases. They're cases that, you know, there are some very important political cases that never see the light of day. And then what you look at the cases they do select, and they're just ridiculous things, you know, like some poor guy putting out flyers that is considered hate speech and having to pay a fine. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court. I mean, who cares if some guy is putting out a flyer in which he says whatever nasty thing he wants to say about this or that religious orientation or sexual orientation or whatever. You know, it is not a national issue that needs to be dealt with the Supreme Court apparatus. Whereas if you have a member of parliament who sues the prime minister over some real nasty things that have been done in back rooms, that doesn't even see the light of day. That gets expelled from the legal consideration early on, and the Supreme Court won't touch it. I mean, you know, they should be dealing with the real cases, and there's enough of them. And instead, they pick these little things that can be better dealt with by discussion in society and by having conferences about it and by having discussion and challenging each other and talking about it in various media. That's the way you deal with these societal questions related to, you know, religion and abortion and all these things. They shouldn't be dealing with that in the Supreme Court when there are all these important, very important political things that structure, you know, that relate to the power structure, how resources are being used, who's going to war and when, and, you know, who's going to be, how the land is going to be used, which peoples are going to be exploited, who is never going to see their rights. You know, there are these huge battles for use of resources, natural resources, land, and so on. Some of those do get to the Supreme Court, but they get machined into these crazy schematic things where it's cut into pieces, reinterpreted what the questions are, and so that the end result is nothing, you know, and they're really good at that. So the cases where they just can't avoid it, they will take them on, but then they treat it with their legal blender, and so you come out the other end 20 or 30 years later, and you still don't have something that's satisfactory. And by that time, the claimants are dead or dying or have moved on, and so on. That's what they're good at. That's what I mean by political. They avoid real cases and mishmash the other real cases that can't be avoided because the world is watching and you can't treat your Aboriginal peoples with complete disdain. And you've signed a treaty that gives them access to the courts, so you can't completely not even allow them in the courts. So you do the legal blender thing. But that's how the courts behave, I find.
Yeah, it is a real shame, Denny. I guess in America, and Canada is so closely associated with America in policies, and it goes back a good number of years, but it's been mostly really, really very close ties economically and politically and militarily, maybe in the last 30, 35 years or so since the 1980s. The Canadian Prime Minister that comes to mind for me was Brian Mulroney. Brian Mulroney. Is he still living? Any idea?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Oh, he's still alive. I mean, it goes back a long way. I mean, the man that he was related to in policy in America, Ronald Reagan. Reagan was a lot older, but he's been gone for a number of years. Oh, maybe half a dozen years or so. And Mulroney is still around, but I remember writing about him when he went to, I think it was the New York Economics Club, and he said that Canada was open for business, meaning that the ties between America and Canada are closer than ever, and it really was a lot more than business. Business meant economic business, military business, political business, and those are the ties that bind today. And again, it's very, very extreme.
Well, Mulroney sold the country to the U.S.
Yes.
He basically handed it over. And there was this North American free trade deal,
yes.
And it was a complete handover. And he did it no matter what, and it had devastating political consequences for his political party because the conservatives went from being in power to being nothing. They were eliminated from the political map for a decade or more as a result of the reaction to Mulroney's policies. That's what I would argue happened there. But it didn't matter. He got the job done, and Canada has never been the same since. That was a big structural change, a complete integration as a satellite of the United States. And the political class has never tried to revert that, you know, and bring us back to being independent. I mean, Canada had a lot of independent moments. Regarding the U.S. in the past. I mean, there was a period there where Canada was truly independent and could go and, you know, Trudeau visited Castro and was buddies with him and so on, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Oh, the music says we're out of time. Oh, there's so much we could talk about this. Canada's policy, to at least to some extent, was very much against the Vietnam War and other policies. Denny, we need to end it because of the music. I look forward to getting you back. There's certainly a lot to talk about, and we'll continue it on future programs. Certainly the next time we have you come on, we'll do it then, and we'll do it on other programs as well. Many, many thanks, Denny.
It was a pleasure, Steve.
Join us again tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.